Hello, I'm David Siddell. This is number 0221, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0221. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, author David O'Keefe, who has written the book One Day in August, which looks at Canada's role during World War II at Dieppe.
Canada had a tremendous reputation coming out of the trenches in World War I. We were the shock army of the British Empire. If there was a tough nut to crack, the Canadians could do it, or we'd die trying. And so as a result, in World War II, up until 1942, we really hadn't done much, and there was a lot of pressure. Mackenzie King was under a lot of pressure at home to get the Canadians into action. And also at that particular time, there's a very strong nationalistic drive by some of the top Canadian generals.
Louise Ashby is an actress and motivational speaker who has been through a lot in life. She survived a horrific accident that required dozens of reconstructive surgery.
I had tubes coming out of every part in my body, and I couldn't open my left eye. I couldn't move my head. And when I did ask for a mirror, everyone, including the doctors, said, "Oh no, we don't have mirrors in the hospital." I was like, "No, that doesn't make sense. I'm sure you have a mirror somewhere." But then, because my memory loss was so bad because of the brain damage, the minute I had been told no and tried to form another sentence, I would forget what I was trying to say.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. He shares the sights and sounds of the city, including the Halloween parade.
But the Halloween parade, you get all kinds of transvestites, transsexuals, homosexuals, gay people, you know, every category. It's a very like a Mardi Gras. It's on Bleecker Street, and it's really wonderful, and it's a lot of fun, and the people are in costume. Peter, it's the kind of thing you go to and you hope you're going to see your high school principal.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0221, was David Siddell, who is a cameraman at Global Montreal, the other place that I work. Actually, one of the best cameramen you'll ever come around, and he's also one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. So it's two for two. As a matter of fact, if you had a chance to see any of the segments that I do, which is called What I Learned on the Web This Week, David is the cameraman on almost all of those segments. Every single one of them does the editing as well, too. So a lot of the kudos for the work that you see in those segments have to also go to David. And by the way, speaking of those segments, you can see those segments. They are linked on my website, thestufffile.com, back to my YouTube page. You can go to, for instance, this week's show, which is number 0221, as you heard David just say. Go to the What's On page for this week, and you'll see the link to the latest edition of What I Learned on the Web This Week. They're, oh, so much fun. Anyway, let's get right to the stuff on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, talk about your bad day. 25-year-old John Knight was driving his Volvo station wagon down Church Street through San Francisco's No Valley neighborhood at about 10:30 in the morning when he came across a strange scene. A heavyset woman stood wrapped in a blanket surrounded by medical personnel. Suddenly, the woman whipped the blanket off and threw it at the medics, revealing that she was completely naked. Then she turned around and noticed Knight, still stopped and now shocked behind the wheel about 50 feet away. "She walks directly to me," he says. "Then she walks up on the hood of my car and begins stomping on my windshield, again completely naked." The woman, who Knight estimated to weigh at around 250 pounds, cracked his windshield with the first stomp. She got a couple more in before plainclothes officers pulled her off and handcuffed her as she screamed. Apparently, the woman had stripped on a commuter train earlier in the morning for no good reason, and it was pure coincidence that Knight pulled up to that intersection at that exact moment. "The insurance company didn't really know what to make of it," Knight said. Yeah, that's not exactly the scenario you see in those touchy-feely insurance commercials, do you? Plus, at 250 pounds and agitated, I'm sure that woman could probably stomp the hell out of a gecko. Anyway, 35-year-old John Lee Baldwin apparently didn't like having proselytizers knock on his Centertown, Arkansas door. He told three Jehovah's Witnesses to leave, complaining, I moved out here to get away from people like you. As they headed back to their car, they say they heard Baldwin turn to someone in the house and say, "Get me my 9-inch," apparently referring to his 9-millimeter pistol. As they drove away, Baldwin allegedly started shooting at them. Police say Baldwin admits he fired about 19 rounds. He was charged with felony aggravated assault. Wow, 19 rounds. But you noticed I didn't mention that he actually hit anything? I guess God was on the side of his intended victims. But I bet you can guess his motive for shooting at them. He didn't want to leave any witnesses. Yeah. Moving right along, a Saudi man divorced his wife after she allegedly videoed their wedding night and left the recording in their hotel room. The bride, whose name wasn't reported, allegedly placed a camera in the couple's hotel room without informing her new husband and recorded more than 50 minutes of their intimate interactions. When the couple left the hotel room, the bride left the camera behind and it was discovered by a hotel employee. The employee, whose name wasn't reported, viewed it and, of course, you know what he did next. Allegedly posted it online. Police arrested the couple and the hotel employee, and though the groom was freed, both the bride and hotel employee remain in custody pending an investigation. The groom divorced his bride, citing a violation of his privacy. Wow, a woman recorded a sex act with her husband in Saudi Arabia. Oh my, don't see this one ending well. Employees at an eyeglasses store at a mall in Sarasota, Florida, called police after a man walked around the store scattering powder, then left. A hazardous materials team responded, and the mall was closed for 2 hours, and no one was allowed to enter or leave. Using surveillance video, the man was identified as 66-year-old Thomas Moran. "I was just scattering ashes," he explained. His fiancée was an optician at the store and died from cancer. The powder was her cremated remains. Spreading her ashes at the store and other spots around town was a last request, he said. Police decided not to press any criminal charges and instead offered Moran grief counseling. You know, I think since she was an optician, he should have had her ground into glasses. You know, make a spectacle out of her. Yeah. And finally, on this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police officer Jody Putnam was called to a store in Mountain City, Tennessee, when store employees noticed a squirrel inside. Putnam allegedly dealt with the issue by pulling his firearm and shooting at the animal inside the store. When that failed to get the intended result, Putnam allegedly switched to pepper spray. There was a lot of people that came out, and just like me, they came out, and they were coughing and hacking, said one witness by the name of Carl Duffield. The town's board of mayor and aldermen fired Putnam, not because he shot at the squirrel, but because he refused to file a report after the incident. Wow. That's the fireable offense in this scenario? Lack of paperwork? You know, sometimes bureaucracy works. Or maybe it doesn't. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? August 19th, 1942 is considered to be a dark day in Canadian military history. That's the day during World War II that an amphibious assault on Nazi-occupied France went horribly wrong, leaving 907 Canadian soldiers dead. But there's a lot more to that story. You may remember last year when we spoke to historian David O'Keefe about the doomed battle when his documentary Dieppe Uncovered came out. Well, now David is back with a book. It's called One Day in August, The Untold Story Behind Canada's Tragedy at Dieppe. David joins us on the line to talk about it. Hi, David.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Nice to have you back on the program with us to talk once again. I was wondering if one of the things that is to your advantage is the convergence of time and opportunity. And by that, I mean you've had the chance to talk to some people who might have been personally involved in this, but also enough time has gone by that governments are declassifying information. Would that be a true statement?
Oh, that's certainly accurate. I mean, a lot of the other historians whose work I've built off of have not had the luxury that I've had. Starting in roughly 1995, at the 50th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, government started a protracted release of material, particularly when it came to things like ultra-secret classifications. And so as a result, when I started this in 1995, really I only had one big piece, one big jigsaw puzzle piece, if you will, and it took about another 20 years for the rest of the pieces to fall in the box. But yes, without a doubt, I certainly have benefited from that time frame.
Okay, you just mentioned ultra-secret. What exactly is an ultra-secret, and how many people would have known about it at the time?
Well, ultra-secret is actually a classification, a security classification that was given. It was actually above top secret. So you have, for instance, secret, most secret, or top secret, and then ultra-secret. And so at this particular time, it was applied to the fruits and the methods of breaking into enemy communications during the Second World War. In other words, German, Japanese, or Italian at that particular time. And sort of reading their email, very much what the, obviously, what the NSA and GCHQ and CSEC in Canada does today. Well, at the beginning of the war, there were only about less than 100, maybe 200 people who were in on this. And this went right from the prime minister to the chiefs of staff, right down to the cryptographers who were actually breaking the enemy codes, the intelligence officers and linguists who were interpreting the message, and a few select commanders in the field, whether that be land, air, or at sea. By the end of the war, there were only about 10,000 people. And now that may sound a lot, but not when you're talking about a world at war when millions of people are in arms. And then in the post-war, the numbers grew, but not substantially. And as a result, what you see developing in World War II when it comes to cryptography has now expanded into those organizations that I mentioned before, the NSA, GCHQ in Great Britain, and CSEC in Canada.
Was there any group or organization, even though a lot of time has now since passed, was there any organization that wasn't as open to your idea of doing first the documentary and now the book?
Well, I can't really say that I've had any true resistance to this. I mean, they are a little careful simply because there are sources and methods, particularly with GCHQ overseas, because a lot of the stuff that they were doing in World War II actually transcended World War II, and they were using the same methods and sources in this Cold War, and some of them even apply today. So they were a little skeptical at first, but when I approached them with essentially 95% of the research done, they really didn't have much room for maneuver, because this story was coming out, and it was just a question of, you know, whether they'd be able to add to it or to confirm or deny, in some cases, some of the information I was bringing to light for the first time.
Now, one of the things that's interesting and fascinating about this whole thing is a person who later became famous for something else had a hand in this, and that is a very young Ian Fleming.
Oh, yes, without a doubt. I mean, one of the challenges for the historian is dealing with a character like Ian Fleming because, you know, he is larger than life. And historically, he's kind of a minefield because there's so much written about him. And in some cases, he's almost bigger than Bond himself. And as a result, the character of Fleming has become lost or, entwined with Bond. So for me, the challenge was to figure out who the real Ian Fleming was, circa 1940 to 42. And although he was nowhere near Bond-like, he was nowhere near a faceless bureaucrat either. I mean, this was a character who was handpicked to be the personal assistant of the Director of Naval Intelligence, John Godfrey, specifically for his character. I mean, he had a certain amount of panache, could get along with everybody, he knew how to grease the wheels, he was from the establishment in England, he could be trusted. But more importantly, he was an ideas man. In other words, if there was anything, no matter how ruthless or Machiavellian, that they needed to develop any type of plan, Fleming was your guy. And so he was tasked very early in the war with coming up with what are called pinch operations. In other words, if you need to steal information regarding the Enigma machine or anything else that you would need for the cryptographers at Bletchley Park to use, well, these operations would be laid on. And right at the beginning of the war, these were Fleming's babies.
What is the biggest misconception that we as Canadians have, and the world at large, about Canada's role and Canada's tragedy at Dieppe?
Well, I think one of the things we always look at it as Canada's operation or a Canadian operation, and it wasn't. This was a British operation. It was developed by Naval Intelligence and Combined Operations, Mountbatten's Combined Operations. It was designed, the outline plan was created by them, and then the Canadians sort of hoisted themselves on, for political reasons, onto the scene and onto the raid. And so basically what you have is a British operation with overwhelming Canadian participation.
Now, you mentioned you mentioned for political reasons. What were those political reasons?
Well, part of it had to do with the fact that Canada had a tremendous reputation coming out of the trenches in World War I. We were the shock army of the British Empire. If there was a tough nut to crack, the Canadians could do it, or we'd die trying. And so as a result, in World War II, up until 1942, we really hadn't done much, and there was a lot of pressure. Mackenzie King was under a lot of pressure at home to get the Canadians into action. And also at that particular time, there's a very strong nationalistic drive by some of the top Canadian generals, in one particular Harry Crerar, who really wanted to put the Canadian Army on the map. So as a result, there was a lot of agitating in the political scene to get the Canadians into action. So although Mountbatten didn't want the Canadians at first, because he wanted his beloved Royal Marine Division to carry out the entire raid, his hand was forced, and the Canadians then joined the party, as they would say.
Now, we talk about the intelligence needed and the type of situation that took place back then in Dieppe, and of course, during World War II, of course, we're hearing all the situations today with how people are treating and talking about intelligence gathering.
Intelligence gathering at the best of times is never 100%.
Right.
It really is an art. And that's one of the reasons why, for instance, historians were always very good at it, or lawyers, because it's a question of interpreting snippets of information within the proper context. And so in this particular case, I mean, mistakes could be made. And you see that, you know, whether it be from the dawn of time when information is processed and then used in decision-making right through both wars of the century and even today.
But do you think, transplanting today's mindset and technology, do you think something like this that took place in World War II would be possible today, what with how people seem to feel about intelligence gathering as a whole?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, back then, and I think this is a fascinating part, at that time, I don't know whether if you could actually strip aside the security issue. If you came out and said, well, you know, we're sorry that this turned out the way it did, but we were doing this for intelligence purposes because you know how powerful intelligence is, I don't know if that argument would have resonated at all in 1942. But now, living in the information age, I certainly can see a disaster like Dieppe, if it were to occur today, I could see them being able to excuse it, security issues aside, of course, because we now understand just how important information is and just how powerful it is.
Now that you've done this book, and again, last year you had the documentary, what have you heard from people who were personally involved, people in the military, families, that kind of thing?
Well, it's really been it's almost been cathartic. I've been getting letters and emails from all across the country with a profound relief is about the only way that I can describe it. And it was amazing because, you know, as I said, when I sat down with Ron Beal, whose quote is on the cover of our book, it was one of the most powerful moments of my entire life. I never expected to sit down and discuss or take a vet through the entire research, but for 3.5 hours, that's exactly what we did. And you could just see, as he put the pieces together, you could see his demeanor changing. And this is a man who, you know, landed on the beach on that day, spent 3 years in a prisoner of war camp, and then for 70 years has been trying to figure out why, you know, what was behind the Dieppe raid. And then suddenly, as this all unfolded, he just looked at me and he said, Dave, he said, you know, now I know why my friends died, and now I can die in peace. So at that particular moment, needless to say, whether you're a historian or, well, just a human, those are incredibly powerful words. And I realized at that time just how powerful history really is and how beautiful the truth can be.
And it's an incredibly powerful book. The book is One Day in August, The Untold Story Behind Canada's Tragedy at Dieppe, written by David O'Keefe. David, thank you very much for being on the program.
Well, anytime, Peter. Thank you.
Military historian David O'Keefe, author of One Day in August, The Untold Story Behind Canada's Tragedy at Dieppe. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0221, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Louise Ashby, who's an actress and motivational speaker with a very horrific personal story to share. Plus, Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. And, of course, we have lots of Stuff File news and an idiot of the day on a program heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. A repairman in Glendale, Arizona, called police to report someone had tried to steal about $300 worth of copper wire from his truck. A spool of wire had been pulled away from the truck, but then left behind. As the technician looked at the mess behind his truck, he found some evidence as to why the thief stopped mid-crime. It wound up in the wire was a fingertip that had been severed in the theft attempt. Police obtained a fingerprint from the severed digit, which led them to Joshua Allen Governman, age 29. Meanwhile, Governman had posted a photo of his hand on Facebook showing a bloody finger stump. I've actually seen the picture. I've been to this guy's website. It doesn't look pretty. Anyway, Governman noted that he, quote, got it caught in a fan belt of a car while helping a friend. When confronted by detectives, that story slightly changed when Joshua observed the other half of his finger now residing in the Glendale Police Evidence Room, a police spokeswoman said. You might say Joshua's finger had its own version of the story to tell and pointed Joshua directly to jail, where he was booked on a theft charge. Well, so as usual, police were working on a tip. Yes. A man walked into a police station in North Hollywood, California, and told officers that he had been trying to get high in his truck by huffing propane. While doing that, he also decided to plug his cell phone charger into the truck's auxiliary outlet, creating a spark that ignited the propane. The resulting explosion blew open the truck's roof and shattered all the windows. The man said he had wandered away from the truck before anyone had arrived and passed out on a lawn somewhere. He was burned on his scalp and face. This guy is the luckiest guy in the world, said Police Sergeant Glenn McNeil. You can't make this stuff up. Yeah, you know, clearly, this is a man who is working his way up the chain of what I like to call the Darwin Starter Kit because, you know, boneheaded, death-defying stunts like this are like peanuts. No one ever stops at just one. It also adds to my theory that there is a God, he has a sense of humor, and there are some folks he simply created for his own amusement to toy with. Meanwhile, after a family evacuated their home in Columbus, Georgia during a fire, family patriarch Walter Serpit grabbed his cane and headed back. "I went back into the house like a dummy," he said. He almost didn't make it back out since the door shut on him and the backdraft was about to kill him. "He had no choice but to go in," he says. "Myself, being an alcoholic, I was trying to get my beer out." He managed to rescue several cans and make it back outside without injury. Well, at least he recognizes himself as being an alcoholic and a dummy. Again, citing the previous story, Darwin's starter kit, God's chew toy. And speaking of religion, various studies show churchgoers to be happier, more optimistic, and healthier than other people, leading some atheists and agnostics to wonder whether the church experience could be fruitfully replicated, but, you know, minus the belief in God. Hence, the Sunday Assembly was created in London and has now spread to New York City and Melbourne, Australia, with 18 other hoped-for openings by year's end. Founders seek such benefits as a sense of community, a thought-provoking secular sermon, group singing, and ethos of self-improvement, exemplified by the motto, "Live better, help often, wonder more." And they hope that eventually Sunday Assembly will organize Sunday schools, really, weddings, funerals, and non-religious baptisms. Well, you know, if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck. They're also planning funerals, huh? Yeah. I've always said the definition of an atheist funeral is all dressed up and nowhere to go. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff All program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Actress Louise Ashby has been through a lot in her life. At the age of 22, her Hollywood dreams were shattered before they even began by a traffic accident that crushed her skull. She had 22 reconstructive surgeries and has over 200 metal bolts and plates in her head. Since then, she has become an international motivational speaker, a coach, is developing a cosmetic line, and is writing her autobiography. Louise joins us on the line right now. Hi, Louise.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
No, I'm very happy to be on. Thank you for having me.
You have been through such a lot, and since you've been through it all, I've seen you pop up in various things like from CNN to other entertainment and news programs. You've been through a lot, and they often say that, you know, the good Lord doesn't give you more than you can handle. Have you always been a person with a strong resolve, or has what happened to you given you a stronger resolve?
Well, as a kid, I did not think that I had a strong resolve, and none of my family members thought I did either. And then when I was 16, my mother sadly got leukemia, and I was her sole caretaker for 5 years. And at the end of the 5 years, she passed away. And the day that she died, I felt like I had been infused with all of her strength. And so, you know, at that young age, suddenly taking care of my brothers and sisters and selling the family house and trying to make something of what had happened to us made me grow up very quickly. While, you know, all my friends were out going to the pubs and going to parties, I was at home looking after my mom and making sure that the kids got off to school and that kind of thing. But also, when she died, I started reaching out to a lot of those self-help books, one of the most prominent being Louise L. Hay's books. And I think the fact that I did that prepared me for what would happen to me less than a year later.
So a year later, you go to California, as I mentioned. You were in this horrific car accident. You had to be taken out of the car via the jaws of life, correct?
Yes.
And I understand. Yes. I understand. For the longest time, while you were recuperating, like right after the accident, no one would show you a mirror.
Well, I was in a coma for 8 or 9 days, and when I came around, all my family were there. which I thought was a bit strange, but then not that strange because I dreamt about the car accident the night before it happened. So it was as if I knew that they would be there. But what was strange was my modeling pictures were on the intensive care unit wall. And when I asked about that, I was told it was to decorate the room because it was so sterile. But it was, in fact, so the doctors could see what I was supposed to look like. And I had tubes coming out of every part of my body, and I couldn't open my left eye. I couldn't move my head. And when I did ask for a mirror, everyone, including the doctors, said, "Oh, no, we don't have mirrors in the hospital." I was like, "No, that doesn't make sense. I'm sure you have a mirror somewhere." But then because my memory loss was so bad because of the brain damage, you know, the minute I had been told no and tried to form another sentence, I would forget what I was trying to say. So that was quite lucky.
So how long was the recuperation for you?
It took 10 years and 27 surgeries, actually. It was 23 reconstructive surgeries, 5 eye surgeries, and 3 brain surgeries.
Wow. When you go through that many surgeries, like when you hit number 20, for instance, do you say, how many of more of these do I have to go through? I mean, how do you prepare yourself for that?
It just becomes part of your life. And because I knew from the age of 4 that I wanted to act, that was always my main goal. And what happened was the first time I did see myself in the mirror was in the hospital. It was about 3 weeks after the accident. The doctor had come in that morning and told me he was coming to take the staples out of my head. And I thought, what? What do you mean I've got staples in my head? And when he took off the bandages, I suddenly felt very cold on my head and realized I had no hair. And so I called a family friend and asked them to bring in some turbans or something to help me cover my head. And when I went into the bathroom that day, a girlfriend came in with me, and I saw myself, and, you know, I didn't recognize what was looking back at me and collapsed on the floor in tears. And she couldn't say to me, it's going to be okay, because she didn't know if it would be okay. And I knew at that time, wow, this is a really, really big, and I have to make a choice now. I can either slip into a depression and I will lose everything in my life, or I can choose to live through this and to be strong and to have a sense of humor about it and keep going. And so that's the choice I made. So every time doubt came into my head over the next 10 years, I had to remember I made a commitment to myself on that bathroom floor that I would be strong and I would get through it. Because ultimately, no matter what experiences happen in any of our lives, we all have a choice, and it's about making the right choice for you.
At what point did you know or did you realize that you could see the light at the end of the tunnel, that things were going to turn out okay for you, even if that journey was long and difficult?
I didn't know if I'd ever be in front of the camera again. While I was disfigured and, you know, going through a lot of surgeries, I didn't want to not be working because I was a trained actress. So I started sending my headshots and resumes to agents and telling them that I wanted to do Star Trek and horror movies because I thought, okay, well, what can I do with this face? Perfect. They won't need to put makeup on me. But nobody else had that sense of humor like I did. They found it a little bit too much. And so as time went on, you know, initially the first 5 surgeons I saw said that there was nothing they could do, that it was too severe of damage. And then I was introduced to a doctor who said he felt he could improve it, not fix it. And so I knew to trust him with that, and I did. And gradually over the years, after each surgery, I could see my face coming more and more back into place. And then it was just the eye surgery that we had to figure out because the eye was stuck in the back of my head and just white. So I guess a moment where I felt kind of funny about it was I auditioned for a Michael Jackson video, and they said they wanted someone to show pain in their eyes. And of course, one of my eyes is blind, and didn't look up. And when I went into the audition, they wanted me to look up into the camera, and I was thinking, oh, I've got to make a theatrical choice here. But I got the job. And so I thought, wow, okay, obviously there's something, that something's being seen. But I was so self-conscious. And another time I did a film, and Eric Roberts was actually in the movie as well, and I went into the dressing room, into the makeup trailer, and the makeup artist was talking to me about my face and my damages, and she said, well, we're going to do very light makeup with this. And I said, okay. And then Eric Roberts came in. We hadn't started my makeup yet, and he sat on my left, and my left is my bad side, and he goes, whoa, they've really done a number on you. And I looked at him and said, what do you mean? And he goes, are you in the death scene? And I said, no, this is my regular face. And he felt really, really bad. And I said, it's fine. I had an accident. Don't worry about it. And then he started telling me a lot of his stories about his accident with his nose and everything else. But, you know, all the years that I had spent getting fixed so that I could be back in front of the camera, I had learned so much more about people and life in general that I decided to write a book about it. And the response I got from the book was so incredible that I then set up a charity for children with my doctor to help children going through disfigurement and to counsel them and their families on how to deal with the reactions from other people, because that's really tough. I mean, I would be asked to leave public places because my appearance was disturbing customers, and that's a lot to put on someone. Luckily, I was strong enough that I didn't take it personally, but it was the people around me that would take it really personally. But I just knew that, you know, my life was back no matter what I looked like. I had to create my dreams in a different way.
You have a website, which is louiseashby.org. What will people find when they go there, and what is it you're trying to get out the most?
I'm just launching the Toolbox to Success program, and it's basically the tools that I used to get from A to B to C to D of my recovery. And it's the same tools that I use in everything in my life, and anyone can use these tools in their lives to accomplish all of their goals. I'm a strong believer that anything is possible if you believe. And one of the programs I have on there is that each person can pay a monthly fee, and then every day they will be sent a new tool to put in practice for that day and put in their toolbox. And it helps you to discover things about yourself that you didn't know you were capable of, and it also helps you get your ducks in a row to go where you want to go, because we all need to know the tools to get there, and if you've got everything mapped out for you, it makes it a lot easier.
You have an amazing story of your life. I wish we had more time to talk. I know you're writing your autobiography. Will you come back on the program when that's ready?
I would love to, absolutely.
Excellent. And people can find out more information by going to your website, which is louiseashby.org. I thank you very, very much, Louise, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. I hope you have a wonderful evening.
Actress and motivational speaker Louise Ashby. Again, you can check out her website at louiseashby.org, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0221, and you'll find the link. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Every week here, we talk about how excessive litigation is robbing Americans of freedoms we've enjoyed for generations. Since this week we honor Americans' veterans, I'd like to talk about one way to salute the men and women who have risked their lives protecting our freedoms. There are a lot of ways to honor those who have served in the military, but one of the best ways is to help a National Guard member or veteran who's looking for a job. Hiring a veteran or guard member honors their service and strengthens employers. No one understands the importance of loyalty, commitment, and initiative like these men and women. So if you're an employer who's now hiring, make a special effort to hire someone who served in the military. There are federal tax credits that reward those who hire veterans, but they expire at the end of the year. If you're not an employer but know someone who is hiring, help spread the word. Let's be fair, when you hire a hero, everyone wins. To get more information about tax benefits for hiring a veteran, download the free booklet on our website at centerforamerica.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And joining us, we do indeed have Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby from New York City, fresh with a brand new mayor. Hello, sir.
Hello. Live from the streets of New York.
I was surprised to see that you have a new mayor, the first Democratic mayor in New York in 20 years. I thought for sure they would have gone with you.
Well, they should have. I mean, I'm the only person who's capable of running the entire United States, but I want to be called despot.
Okay. So how do you feel about the new mayor now that he's been formally elected?
I don't trust him, and I'll tell you why I don't trust him.
Okay.
Here's a guy who was in relative obscurity, but he was a public figure. Just as his campaign began, excuse me, that's the cold air coming from the north, he announces that he's married to a black lady. That's kind of interesting. Then he announces that he's married to a black lady who used to be a lesbian before they got together.
Yeah, I read all of that, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, I'm not making an attack on black people or lesbians. I just, like, why was that never even, you know, around, and all of a sudden it is around? And then the other thing is, he has two kids. One is a boy and one is a girl. Well, all of a sudden, if almost by for the election, the black kid starts wearing an afro. As a matter of fact, when Obama met him, he said, oh, what a great haircut. So what am I talking about here? I don't know. It's just something that I just feel that this guy is sort of like an opportunist. Did he figure that maybe he'd get black votes, that he finally revealed his wife was black? Or now does that mean he's going to get the gay votes? It was just like the timing of it. So it has me a little bit unsettled. So I'm really not working with very substantial facts here. But I'm telling you my emotions. There's something about this guy. I just get the feeling I don't trust him. I don't know why, but there it is. I was honest with you.
Well, I had seen the same stories that you're referring to, and also a vehement denial by his daughter that his family was never under wraps and that it was always public knowledge and that her father, was definitely not an opportunist. I'm just putting that out there.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, I'm interested in that because I didn't see that article, and the statement that I just made to you and your nice listeners was really completely independent of that, because I could have almost said to you, now I may be the only person who's thinking this. Well, obviously, you've just told me that I'm not the only person who was thinking of it if she is kind of denying it. So, you know, to me, that's an interesting aspect right there. I have some guy who's outside New York City telling me what's going on in New York City, so you're to be complimented.
And by the way, that was also mentioned in an article in last week's People magazine, so you're not alone. You're not alone.
I guess I'm not. But like I say, you know, you go sometimes, you know, when you talk about profiling and gut reactions and everything, well, that unfortunately, that's part of the human condition. I mean, we operate on two levels. We all operate with intellect and facts and what have you. And then everybody has a certain feeling about something or other, which may be inappropriate, may be wrong, but that's part of being a human being. And there's something about this guy I just don't trust. And I guess we'll find out, because he's going to be the mayor, so that's the only way we're going to find out how good or bad he's going to be.
Absolutely. Let's go on to another election, one that's down the road, but it does have tentacles in what's going on today, and that is the Hillary campaign. It seems that she is unofficially running for president in 2016, but she is endorsing people like Chuck Schumer, your senator.
Well, wait a minute. She is really running because Chuck Schumer is the guy, the senator, one of our two senators, who announced that she should run for president. That's almost like that moment when he said that, that's the beginning of her campaign, because Schumer would never have said that if it wasn't afoot. I mean, he's a very careful guy about how he plays every side against every side. So you could say that she is now officially running for president of the United States. Now, an interesting aspect to that is that I think she and a lot of people are going under the assumption that because she's a woman, she's going to get all the lady votes. Not necessarily, because I've heard from a lot of women who say they're not going to vote for her because of the fact that she let Bill off the hook. They don't think that that's so sweet that a wife would let her husband get away with that kind of stuff. Now, you might say, well, what does that have to do with being president? Well, again, that's those gut feeling reactions. And you figure, you know, that maybe she should have cut off as you know what. So she is definitely running. Unfortunately, she's running on her record of being a Democrat, of being a woman, and being married to Bill. I don't see any substance in her, beyond that. But that's American politics. We've seen, I'm not going to say we, because it's not me, they, the other Americans I'm talking about, vote for people on very shallow, shallow reasoning.
Now, I know the words that are etched on the bottom of or around the Statue of Liberty, and I know that there's, the huddled masses yearning to break free, which brings me to the amount of people in New York who voted recently who were not born in the United States, but rather born abroad.
Yeah, well, it's 3 out of 10 now, which is an awful lot. Now, I'm not finding fault with the fact that that's people from outside, because presumably, I guess, maybe they were okay to vote. But wait a minute. I voted, yesterday, the day before? I lost track of days now. Nobody asked me for any identification. I mean, now, this is not Alabama or Mississippi where they're making you show something. This is not like Florida where they don't seem to care. This is supposedly enlightened New York City. I think it would have been nice for somebody to ask me to show some identification. So I think what's happening is that you have a lot of foreign people coming into the United States who may not necessarily be supposed to be voting. I don't know if it's 3 out of 10, but I think that's a very shaky thing. And, we've gotten to a point now, if you ask somebody for identification before they vote in the United States, you're somehow infringing on their liberties. You shouldn't ask that question. Well, I mean, come on, let's not get crazy about this thing.
Meanwhile, I understand, and this is one I just don't understand completely, actually, the minimum legal age to buy cigarettes in New York is on the verge of being raised from 18 to 21.
Yeah, well, it's a nice idea, but it's unenforceable, and I think it's a very bad thing to make laws that aren't going to be enforced because then you have a disregard for law, and that's a bad idea. The reason why I'm saying it's unenforceable, New York is not a city of malls. We are a city of thousands and thousands and thousands of little grocery stores, bodegas, candy stores, diners. I mean, it's just the thought that you're going to be able to regulate that is absolutely ridiculous. It's just not going to happen. So you're going to have people still buying cigarettes, still smoking cigarettes, and saying, hey, I got away with this law. Maybe I'll get away with another law. It's kind of silly. It's good intention, but kind of silly.
Again, the reason why I don't understand it is I've always been a firm believer that if at 18 you're old enough to get married, old enough to get a job, have a license, old enough to volunteer to be killed and fight for your country, then I don't think there should be anything else that you shouldn't be allowed to do. That's smoking, that's drinking. And by the way, those are two things I don't do. But if you're old enough to literally legally be an adult, then you're an adult. I don't get it.
Well, I tell you this, after what you just said, I will never turn down an invitation to a party at your house.
And finally, what's the deal about Brooklyn women being the pickiest in the country?
Well, that supposedly this was some online dating service and said Brooklyn, which is one of our boroughs, that the women there are the pickiest when it comes to men. And I had a laugh about that because I'll tell you why. I don't know that that's true. I don't even think it's true. But I grew up in the Bronx, and when I was growing up in the Bronx, we were told that the girls in Brooklyn were very fast. So, of course, we immediately made for the nearest subway to go to Brooklyn so we could go to parties where we would meet Brooklyn girls who would be fast. Well, in those days, nobody was fast. I mean, you'd be lucky if you had a kiss goodnight. So we went out to Brooklyn to go to a few parties, and we found that, no, the Brooklyn girls weren't any faster. So I don't know whether or not they're really pickier, but I can tell you right now, at least in the days gone by, in my youth, they were not fast, unfortunately.
Hmm. And one more thing, celebrity sighting. I understand you saw someone at a Halloween parade.
Yeah, a guy named Jamie Foxx.
Jamie Foxx.
Yeah. Excellent. Why, did I say something wrong?
No, nothing at all.
Oh, I thought I maybe had his name wrong or something.
No.
No, you know what? First of all, at the Halloween parade, you get all kinds of transvestites, transsexuals, homosexuals, gay people, you know, every category. It's a very, like a Mardi Gras. It's on Bleecker Street, and it's really wonderful, and it's a lot of fun, and the people are in costume. Peter, it's the kind of thing you go to, and you hope you're going to see your high school principal. So there was certainly a lot of celebrities there, and it just so happened that when my wife and I, you know, I took her along for protection, when my wife and I were standing there, he was right standing next to us as a spectator. And I was trying to think of all kinds of clever things I could say to him, like, why aren't you in drag and this and that. But, you know, I don't like to bother these guys because their private life or something or other. But like I always say, it's a lot of fun to see celebrities. I have not yet gotten so blasé, even living in New York, that it's not a big deal. I think it's a big deal and a lot of fun. And by the way, one of the best reasons for living in New York is you're going to be standing on a street corner and the guy next to you is Harrison Ford or Jamie. You know, it's just amazing.
And one of the true reasons I'm sure you didn't talk to him is the fact that he might have turned to you and realized that he was standing next to the Gabby Cabby.
Well, I thought of that too, but remember the movie that he was in which he was driving, what's his name, around? It escapes me now. You know, the guy, the killer. And Jamie Foxx had to drive him around.
Yes.
As he was killing people. You remember, Mr. Master of Trivia, do you know the movie I'm thinking of?
I'm envisioning the film, but I can't remember the name at this very moment.
Okay, well, it's good. I'm glad to see I'm not the only person having a senior moment.
There you go. They're coming more frequently as I age. Peter, it's always a delight to talk to you. People can find out more information by going to your website at www.gabby.com. They could also send you an email to peter@gabby.com. Thank you very much, sir.
Oh, my pleasure. Everybody have a wonderful day.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program, but I do have some more Stuff File news to share with you. Arielle Sinclair, age 23, an assistant manager at a Rite Aid drugstore in Virginia Beach, Virginia, was charged in October with stealing $6,000 from the store's Virginia State Lottery machine. According to police, access to the machine requires an authorized fingerprint, which she supplied, apparently failing to think ahead that this would eventually be difficult to explain. We work a lot of different cases, said a police spokesperson, and some are easier than others. Well, there's an understatement. You know, I almost made her the idiot of the day. I was seriously thinking about it, but I didn't, no. But this next person, this would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
This story proves that stupidity can happen multiple times in the same day. Troy F. Mitchell, age 47, was out of prison on supervised release when he handed a note to a teller at a Valley First Credit Union in Modesto, California, demanding $5,000 in cash. While the teller was getting the money, another teller walked by and said, "Hi, Troy." Mitchell acknowledged the greeting and left with the $5,000. The second teller recognized Mitchell from when he applied for a loan, and the application file included a copy of his driver's license. Now, before he could be arrested, though, Mitchell struck again, handing a note to a teller at a different bank demanding $100 bills. That time, he got $5,100. Mitchell left the note behind. It was written on the back of his pay stub, which included his current address. Confronted with the evidence, Mitchell pleaded guilty to 2 counts of bank robbery. Now, why would somebody be so dumb as to first rob a bank where he previously made a loan application, only to follow that up with robbing a bank using the back of his pay stub as a robbery note and then leaving it there? Well, one reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0221. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0221. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes. Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.